welcoming all of you to our Triad month number four presentation. We have with us today two excellent presenters, Seth Pitkin of Stone Environmental in Montpelier, Vermont. And for presentation two this afternoon, we'll have Dr. Mark Cram, who's with Groundswells Technologies Incorporated in Santa Barbara, California. And we'll be kicking it off with Seth in just a second. Just wanted to make it just a comment that, you know, we've been having a lot of fun putting together Triad Month here, and we think that it's a very useful thing. We're following up on our Triad conference last year in June up at UMass Amherst, and in this session we're going to be looking at high-resolution groundwater characterization methods and the Triad approach. Seth will be doing that. That examines the principles of reducing sampling uncertainty as an essential element and reducing the uncertainty associated with key site management decisions. And Dr. Mark Cram, who I think many of us are familiar with as well, is going to be presenting hydraulic parameter and mass flux distribution using high-resolution piezocone and GCMS, which is going to demonstrate the use of the piezocone direct push sensor probe to determine the direction, the rate of groundwater flow in three dimensions. So, Beth, if you're ready to go, we'll be moving along with you.
Okay, yeah, I'm all set.
Hey, that sounds very good. And let's see. Go ahead, Seth. If you want to tell us a little bit about Stone, that'd be okay. I know that you guys do sustainable development, water resources, agrochemical phase exposure, integrated site management, and apply the information in GCMS, so GIS rather. So plenty of stuff.
That pretty much covers us. So I think I'll dive right in the interest of time. The first slide, hopefully everybody can see on their monitor, is just the title slide, High Resolution Site Characterization and the Triad Approach. And as Kirby said, this presentation is focused on groundwater. A lot of Triad investigations are focused on the shallow portions of sites, the surface and shallow surface soils. We've been applying Triad mostly to groundwater problems, particularly DNAPL-type problems, and that's the emphasis in this presentation. So slide two shows the contents of the presentation. It's basically broken into three parts, the first being a little review of spatial variability in porous media, the second section, a little overview of contamination in fractured rock, and the third portion of the presentation looks at actual high-resolution site characterizations and ways that those can be accomplished. So slide three shows three little windows of hydraulic head distributions. The title is Gasoline Plume Site in Vermont, Variability of Hydraulic Gradient with Depth. The first of the three rectangles shows a shallow slice up near the water table at an elevation of 585 feet above mean sea level, and the hydraulic head contours show a pretty pronounced trough into which groundwater flows and then flows off to the north or the top of the picture. The picture to the right of that is a little bit deeper in the aquifer at 574 feet of elevation, and you can see that flow is generally to the north, northwest, and then down below, the last picture shows flow essentially from east to west. So this is a pretty profound difference in hydraulic gradients and flow directions with elevation in an aquifer over a pretty small distance. And I just show this to keep people focused on the fact that the surface that you get when you put in some water table wells is not necessarily going to inform you as to the flow paths of contaminants at all portions of the aquifer. It really is a three-dimensional flow field, and flow patterns can vary significantly with depth. So we're going to go to slide four, and this is titled Hydrodynamic Dispersion. Dispersion was heavily studied in the 80s and early 90s, there were a series of natural gradient tracer tests performed, Stanford-Waterloo test being one of the first and most well-known. The USGS conducted a similar test on Cape Cod a couple of years later. Mike Rivett did a solute test, again at Canadian Forces Base Borden, and there were others as well. And the upshot of all these studies was that hydrodynamic dispersion, though it's scale-dependent, is generally very weak in directions transverse to the primary direction of flow, particularly in the vertical dimension, which means that plumes don't spread out or mix a lot, except in the direction of flow or primary transport. And dispersion in that direction is actually pretty significant. But vertical, very, very weak, typically on the order of molecular diffusion, and transverse, though less weak, is still a pretty weak process. So slide five is titled Rivett's Experiment, the in-place source site. And you can see a photo there of Mike Rivett's experimental site. The little box in the foreground is the size of the emplaced source that he put below the water table. And then you can see a large number of pipes sticking up out of the ground. And each of those pipes is a multi-level sampling device, which has 14 different sampling ports at different elevations in it. And you can see schematically the sampling array, both in cross-section and in plan view to the right. So very, very detailed characterization. And the next slide, slide six, shows trichloromethane plume at 322 days coming out of Mike's emplaced source. And you can see that this plume is long and narrow, and that's typical due to weak dispersion. So that's what we're up against when we're dealing with DNAPL sources creating plumes. These plumes typically are pencil-like plumes coming off of the source areas, and there may be multiple plume cores like these in a larger overall plume. Slide 7 shows the distribution of hydraulic conductivity, or K, at Canadian Forces Base Borden, which is essentially a beach sand aquifer. And this work was done by Ed Siddiqui back in the 80s at the site of the Stanford-Waterloo tracer test. And Ed basically collected a number of cores, which are shown in this diagram, in an X pattern. He cut the cores up into 5-centimeter chunks and ran permeameter tests on the 5-centimeter chunks of aquifer and calculated the mean, the geometric mean of the hydraulic conductivity, and also started to look at the spatial variability. And you can get a sense of that spatial variability from this diagram, in which the red colors are relatively high hydraulic conductivities, the blues are relatively low, and the green and yellow is in between. It's only a couple of meters from the bottom to the top of this diagram, and the space between each of the cores is 1 meter. So you can see that even in this crude graphical representation, hydraulic conductivity is varying significantly over pretty small distances. And slide 8 is a autocorrelation plot of hydraulic conductivity from Ed Siddiqui's data at Borden. And essentially what an autocorrelation plot is an R-squared for all data that are separated by a specific distance. So the distance on the x-axis is in centimeters, and the autocorrelation of log K is on the vertical axis. And you can see that the R-squared drops off quite quickly from an R-squared of 1 with no lag distance to an R-squared of about 0.63, and then it drops down, crosses 0, which means totally uncorrelated, at a lag distance of about 12 to 15 centimeters. So what this shows is that the vertical correlation length for hydraulic conductivity in the Borden aquifer is only about 12 centimeters. And moving on to slide 9, we see a table of hydraulic conductivity correlation lengths here for a number of sites that have been studied in detail. Borden, Canadian Forces Base Borden, Ontario being one at the top. And the horizontal correlation length is 2.8 meters in that aquifer, and again, the vertical is about 12 centimeters. from the USGS worked at POTUS Air National Guard Base at the Mass Military Reservation. You can see that the horizontal K correlation length is 2.9 up to as much as 8 meters horizontally. And the vertical correlation length is 18 centimeters to about 38 centimeters. Ray Feltz, Steve Young, and others at Columbus Air Force Base have done similar types of work and found a horizontal correlation length of 12.7 meters and a vertical correlation length of K at 1.6. And you can see these other ones. The Eifelgen, Germany one is real interesting. It's 15 to 20 meters horizontally, but only 5 centimeters vertically. And then Chalk River, Ontario is quite similar to Borden. So hydraulic conductivity varies a lot over short distances, even in what would normally be described as pretty uniform or homogeneous materials. And this has pretty profound implications for site characterization and remediation as well. So slide 10 now is a cross-section, a geologic cross-section at Pease Air Force Base Site 32 in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. And this is kind of a typical sort of geologic cross-section that you would find in a consulting report. At the top, we've got sort of an upper sand unit. It's a blue hatched zone. And then the yellow zone is a marine clay and silt. And there's a lower sand, another blue hatched unit below that. And down below is a till unit with a couple of different components of the till. And we're going to be looking at the hydraulic conductivity distributions along this cross-section. So the next slide, number 11, shows the hydraulic conductivity distribution on VB prime, which is that same cross-section. And here you can see there's a key on the right, 10 to the minus 7 going down to a yellow, 10 to the minus 2. That's centimeters per second hydraulic conductivity. And we can see the marine clay and silt is a purplish color in the middle. It's about 10 to the minus 6 centimeters per second with a few zones of 10 to the minus 7 centimeters per second in it. And then we can see the light blue and green lower sand just below that, and then the dark blue till at the bottom with a little light blue as well. So now we're going to focus even more on the lower sand in the area of WDP4 through WC17 up there at the top. And this is a little tiny piece of this lower sand unit, which is just one of many units in this heterogeneous formation. It's about 50 feet across from left to right, and it's about 7 feet thick. So it's pretty small, and we've got a whole bunch of hydraulic conductivity measurements here. Each of the black dots there, which look like continuous lines, are hydraulic conductivity measurements. And you can see that we vary across 3 orders of magnitude in hydraulic conductivity in this small piece of ground in what's defined as a single unit, the lower sand. So this has serious implications for DNAPL movement, certainly, because where you have lower hydraulic conductivities, you typically have higher capillary pressures, and that's going to hang up DNAPL and redirect DNAPL movement. It's also going to cause preferential flow of contaminants within that sand unit. The slide 13 is from this same site, and it shows variability in KD, or the soil water partitioning coefficient, on the left, and hydraulic conductivity on the right for one of those coring locations. Excuse me. And you can see that even the KD is quite variable spatially over very short vertical distances. Varies by about a factor of 4 over just a few centimeters. As does the hydraulic conductivity. It's varying over more than an order of magnitude there. So just about everything you can think of that, by way of important variables in contaminant transport and fate, are quite variable over small distances. And so understanding what's going on at the site requires looking at these variables at a very close scale and understanding what the distribution of contaminant mass is. And that's what high-resolution site characterization is all about. So now we're looking at slide 14, mass flux distribution. And this comes from a paper by Martin Yobo, Beth Parker, and John Cherry in Groundwater in 2005. Martin looked, as part of his thesis, at three sandy sites that were contaminated with chlorinated solvent DNAPLs, and characterized them in a very high-resolution fashion, And what he found was that 75% of the mass discharge coming out of these sites actually moves through about 5 to 10% of the cross-sectional area of the plume. So when you stop and think about that for a minute, it's pretty impressive that almost all the mass, three-quarters of the mass, is in very small little zones. And the likelihood of finding those zones with a few monitoring wells placed here and there on a site is very, very low. So investigation of these sites really requires a different approach, and Mark Cram's going to talk about measuring flux on a high-resolution sense right after this. But we're going to look at some ways that can be done here as well. So now we're going to look at contaminants in fractured rock. We're turning from porous media to fractured rock. And we're going to go to slide 16, which is a picture of a sandstone outcrop in Southern California. And you can see the fractures in this sandstone. There is matrix porosity in the sandstone, but most of the water moves through the secondary porosity, that is the fractures of joints that occur in the sandstone. And typically we've looked at fractured bedrock aquifers through the eyes of the fractures. That is, that's where all the water moves, so that's where we've paid the most attention. And that still makes a lot of sense. But there's also, in these porous rocks, a lot of mass potentially present in the primary porosity as well. And it's that mass in the primary porosity that can give us our biggest problems in terms of remediation and trying to clean up these aquifers. So slide 17, we can see factors that are important in flow in fractured media. And those are the aperture of the fractures, or the width of the opening of the fracture, the spacing of the fractures, how far apart they are, how densely they occur within the bulk rock, the orientation of the fractures, what directions they tend to trend in, or whether they're random, and, of course, connectivity, how connected the different fractures are with one another. Slide 18, we're looking at dual porosity media. So we have, in a lot of these rocks, we have primary porosities anywhere between 2% and 25%. So it would be a sandstone or a limestone or, any kind of sedimentary rock that has significant primary porosity. The secondary porosity in the fractures, which is where all the rock, all the water is flowing through the rock, is much, much smaller. It's maybe a tenth of a percent to a thousandth of a percent. So in spite of the fact that that's where the water movement happens, it's a very minor part of the overall porosity of the medium. So moving to slide 19, this is from Beth Parker's PhD thesis back in the early 90s, published in Groundwater 1994. And you can see that DNAPL invades these fractures, if it has enough pressure head to overcome the capillary resistance. And once it's in the fracture, it starts to dissolve in whatever water is present. And once in the dissolve phase, it begins to diffuse under a concentration gradient into that primary porosity in the matrix. And you can see the little dots around the DNAPL. As time goes on and the DNAPL dissolves, the contaminant mass moves further and further into the rock matrix, creating these diffusion halos around the fractures where the DNAPL was present. And then at even later time, the DNAPL is completely gone, but a significant amount of mass has now penetrated into those matrix blocks and is residing in the so-called immobile porosity in the matrix. And it then takes a long time for that mass to come back out of those matrix blocks under diffusion. And that's what can foil a lot of otherwise good remedies. So moving on to slide 20, we see a cross-sectional cartoon here where we have a source zone. The DNAPL is moving down through a number of fractures and moving horizontally. As you move down plume a bit, the DNAPL has become depleted in those fractures, and we've got a lot of contaminant mass locked up in the primary porosity due to diffusion into the matrix. And as we'll see a little bit later, that actually serves to retard the advance of the plume overall. So slide 21, we're going to look at some high-resolution site characterization investigation types. Slide 22, the high-resolution approach. Essentially, the way we like to approach groundwater investigations is with transects. These are just cross sections across the direction of flow, or or normal to the direction of flow, 90 degrees to the direction of flow, so that you can create a complete picture of what's coming across that transect, and in some cases back project into the source zone to try to figure out what's going on in the source zone. A couple other little bits of terminology. When we talk about sample interval, we're talking about the vertical dimension of the sampled portion, the ACFR, or what we're used to thinking of as the screen length. And the sample spacing is actually the distance between the samples vertically. So what we'd really ideally like to see is a very short vertical interval so we don't get dilution on the well screen, and a very close vertical sample spacing so we can get very high resolution pictures of the contaminant distribution. And all of this ideally is also done with real-time or very near real-time tools or instruments, and is done with a dynamic or adaptive approach in keeping with the triad approach, so that you can learn from what you're doing while you're doing it and adjust your methods in process. Slide 23 is a list of high-resolution tools. Cone penetrometers at the top of the list, and Mark will be teaching us a little more about that in a minute. Laser-induced fluorescence, which can be used with CPT or with other tools, and includes UVOST and TARGOST, which are designed for specific applications, PAHs and petroleum hydrocarbons. There's a membrane interface probe, sold by Geoprobe in wide use now, particularly in triad-type investigations. The Napa ribbon sampler, which is part of the Flute and Geoprobe toolkits. The Waterloo Advanced Profiling System, which is a new generation of the Waterloo Profiler. And then old-fashioned techniques like soil coring and subsampling. This is analogous to the matrix diffusion problem in rock, where we have silts and clays in sands and gravels. We can get a lot of diffusion into those silts and clays that then diffuses back out. So it's important to sample those silts and clays, which is best done using soil sampling techniques, since it's very difficult to get water out of them. And if you don't sample those, there's a high risk that you're going to miss a lot of contaminant mass that could come back to haunt you at a later time. All of these techniques can be used with some degree of on-site analytical chemistry, so that you can have real-time or near real-time data. And then, of course, the Bedrock toolbox includes a technique called Core DFN that we'll talk a little bit about. Borehole geophysics, which has been used for a long time, including borehole flow meters and packer testing and that kind of thing. The Flute K profiler, which is a relatively new approach that's been added to the Flute liner toolbox. And then more conventional multi-level wells like West Bay, Solenst, and Flute. Slide 24. Using these data in a collaborative manner, the title of the slide is Collaborative Data in Porous Media, MIP, Waterloo APS, Soil Core Profiling, and On-Site Analytical. So we can get the most out of these techniques when we use them with one another, and they complement each other in terms of the types of data that they get and contribute the contribution they make to our understanding. The MIP, as most of you know, is a rapid screening tool. You can get a lot of linear footage done in a day, and you can screen a site very quickly, figure out where the plume cores are, maybe where the source areas are, and then come in using other techniques for more detailed and more definitive types of sampling. One of those types of sampling would be the Waterloo APS, or Advanced Profiling System, which provides actual samples which can be analyzed for speciation and defensible concentrations. Again, soil subcore profiling is a method where you can get all the water data from the permeable units and then get mass distribution in the aquitards using soil coring and subcore sampling. Both the Waterloo and the soil sampling would be done with on-site laboratories to help you figure out what's going on in real time and adjust accordingly. Slide number 25 is titled Spatial Relationships of K and C. And K refers to hydraulic conductivity, and C refers to concentration. The graph on the left was data from a source area, and the graph on the right is from down plume a ways, further down from the source area. And you can see that we've got, on the bottom of each plot, we've got the TCE concentration in log scale, On the top, we've got the hydraulic conductivity values in log scale, and the vertical axis is depth in meters. So on the left, in the source area, we see that, hydraulic conductivity and concentration have an inverse relationship with one another. That is where the hydraulic conductivity is low, the concentrations are high, and vice versa. Where the hydraulic conductivity is high, the concentrations are relatively low. But when we move down plume, we see that the relationship between the two is direct, and that where hydraulic conductivity is low, concentrations are low, and where hydraulic conductivity is high, concentrations are high. And intuitively, that makes sense in that the transport from the source area is happening in these high K zones. This will change over time, though, when mass begins to diffuse from these high K zones into the lower K units on each side of it, and particularly after remediation begins and the high K zones get cleaned out preferentially earlier, then the mass will begin to diffuse back out of those low K zones into the high K zones. So moving on to slide 26, we look at some MIT data, continuous real-time profile. And on the left, we see the electrical conductivity log that the MIT produces. And basically, the further to the left the MIP log, the EC log goes, the coarser the material is, and the further to the right, the finer the material is. So it looks like this material is getting finer as one goes deeper in the borehole. And then we can see the PID, ECD, and FID detectors to the right of the EC log. And we see in each of those that there's a high degree of contamination. The ECD, electron capture detector, is responding most strongly to these contaminants, which it should since they're chlorinated solvents. But the FID and the PID are both responding as well at these high concentrations. And in fact, the ECD has pegged, it's reached its maximum, and we can't get any more information out of that, but the PID and the FID both still have some response left, so we can learn something from that. Now, it's a little hard to know what kind of concentration you have with these voltage responses, or even when you cross over from dissolved and sorbed contamination to NAPL phase contamination. In fact, when we pulled the tool out of the ground at this particular location, there was DNAPL in the rods that we could see. So in this case, we knew that there was DNAPL present. But the data themselves don't readily lend themselves to that interpretation without additional data. Slide 27 is titled Waterloo Profiler, Near Real-Time Closely Spaced Profile. And this is at the same location as the MIP log we just saw previously. These are co-located logs for two different tools. And you can see the index of hydraulic conductivity, or IK, is the graph on the left. And that's dropping off, becoming lower, moving further to the left, as we get deeper. And with the index of hydraulic conductivity, lower values indicate lower hydraulic conductivity. So this jibes with the MIP data, and it looks like the particle size is getting finer, the aquifer is getting less permeable down toward the bottom. But unlike the MIP, we see two significant lower K zones, one at about 27 feet and the other at about 37 feet. And those appear to be correlated a little bit with where the contaminant concentrations begin to climb. The second graph, labeled head, is the depth to the potentiometric surface. And you can see that that increases slightly with depth, meaning that there's a downward component to the hydraulic gradient, downward into this fine-grained material. And then we're looking at 12DCE, 111TCA, TCE, and TCE as we move from left to right. And these are log-scale concentrations, and in fact, the high concentrations we see for 111TCA and TCE are effective solubility limit concentrations. That is, that's about the maximum amount of those compounds you can get into water in the dissolved phase in the presence of these other compounds. So that tells us that one would expect DNAPL there, which was, of course, confirmed by the presence of the DNAPL in the MIP rods and subsequent presence of DNAPL that was recovered from wells that were installed in this area. Slide 28, this is it's meant to be an animated slide, but it's all just lumped here in one slide for our purposes today. This is a site in northern England, an old industrial site that had actually been remediated, and I think the cost of the remediation was something like 4 million British pounds, which of course is a significantly greater number of U.S. dollars. And it was clear that there was still some contamination left. There were some wells that had been put in at the conclusion of the remedy, and those wells are shown with a black line and some screened intervals. You can see MBH2A, for example, on the right-hand side of the diagram. There's a screen partway down, and then there's a screen at the bottom of that black line. And the concentrations in that bottom screen were basically non-detect. The concentrations in the top screen were right around 100 to 200 ppb of trichlorobenzenes. The well ERM3 was screened right on top of bedrock, and it had concentrations in the hundreds up to maybe a ppm of the trichlorobenzenes as well. So when we went in and began to do some profiling, which is shown by the red lines and the red dots, we saw, first of all, that the contamination was distributed throughout the aquifer at WP13, not just down at the bottom where the screen of the well was. And the concentrations in some cases were significantly higher than what we saw in the monitoring wells. We did stop where the arrow is pointing to on each profile, where we went from a sandy zone to a silty and clayey zone, which is where the IK profile, or the brown line, deflects to the left. We stopped at those interfaces and started pumping. And the photograph in the center shows a little DNAPL blob in the bottom of a vial. And in fact, we got DNAPL out of both of those holes at the interface between the high and low K zones, and actually were able to pump significant quantities of DNAPL out of there. So this is a case where the method of investigation at these two locations in a pretty small area told two very, very different stories. One was that there was a minor amount of contamination left in the aquifer, and the other was that there was gross contamination throughout the aquifer. So moving on to slide 29, it's titled Soil Subcore Profiling, What's in the Aquitard? And this is a pretty simple process that can yield a lot of data very quickly. I think it's very cost effective. It's probably not used as often as it should be. Not sure why that is, but it's kind of the case. And the way we do it basically is to get a core out of the ground using a geoprobe or other direct push technique, and we drill a hole through the liner. We use a little stainless steel subcoring tool, push it through the hole so it's filled with soil, and then we extrude that little subcore into a vial containing methanol that's been pre-weighed and prepared in advance. And on the right, you can see some little soap subcores that have been dropped into that methanol vial. They're then taken off to an on-site lab and extracted and analyzed. You can analyze a large number of them in a day in an on-site lab and get a pretty cost-effective price. The one thing you need to be careful of when analyzing aquitards is the extractions and making sure that the extractions are complete. You need to completely disaggregate those things in order to get all the mass out of it. And that's not always done in standard methodologies. Slide 30 is titled Soil Subcore Sampling, Near Real-Time Closely Spaced Profile. And this is just a TCE profile in log scale with depth on the y-axis. And the striking thing about this is a series of non-detects down to about 6 feet, and then all of a sudden we get about a 6 or 7 order of magnitude increase up to 10 to the 7th micrograms per kilogram, then a slight drop-off, and we're into the 10,000 microgram per kilogram range and higher for the rest of that profile. So you can get a lot of variability in these aquitards, and you can also get a lot of data very quickly and very cheaply that can help you figure out how much mass is present that you're going to have a hard time getting to with your remedial technologies. So slide 31 shows the core DFN approach. DFN stands for Discrete Fracture Network, and this is an approach developed by Beth Parker and John Cherry and others at the University of Waterloo and now the University of Guelph. And it's there's a lot to this approach. Basically, it all begins with coring holes into the bedrock, and then you can make measurements in the holes on the right in the green, and you can make measurements on the cores on the left in the blue. What's kind of unique about this technique is the measurements on the cores, in that it actually collects the matrix and processes it to find out how much mass or what kind of concentrations are present in the rock matrix itself or in the pore space in the rock matrix. So you get these VOC samples that you collect. You also get rock physical property samples that you collect and rock chemical property samples that you can collect. And then you can calculate matrix pore water concentrations from all of those. And there's currently a bunch of research underway to try to get a better handle on degradation. And does that occur in the fractures only? Does it occur in the matrix, in the pore space in the matrix? And is it different in terms of organisms? Is it different in terms of rates and that sort of thing? That's all an active area of research and is not clear just yet how that's going to work out. The measurements in the core holes are broken out into long-term and short-term. In the short term, you can make measurements in the open hole, and you can make other measurements in a lined hole. Now, leaving a hole open is not a good idea in most of these sites because you can get very rapid cross-contamination that can then have some pretty long-term effects. But while the hole is open, you can do groundwater sampling with Packer testing or other techniques. You can do borehole geophysics. You can use flow meters to get a better sense of flow in and out of the borehole. You can do temperature logging as well. In the lined hole, you can do a new type of temperature logging that a fellow named Pete Pemmy is pioneering, which is very high-resolution temperature logging that you can actually see through the liner these temperature fluctuations that give a very good indication of active fractures. Then there's also flute K profiling, which is a way of getting a complete profile of the hydraulic conductivity distributions continuously down the borehole. And you can do other geophysical techniques in the lined hole as well. Ultimately, after you've got all these data, you can design a long-term monitoring system, put in your multi-level wells where you can measure hydraulic head contaminant concentrations over time. All these data can be put into mathematical models, which can help in making decisions about the site. Slide 32 is just a picture of some rock core. The samples are indicated by the little blocks that have been labeled that are placed in the core box. Some of them are for physical property samples, and some of them are for VOC samples. Slide 33 is a cartoon of the results of the approach. So you just core down through the bedrock. You collect samples at a high frequency, usually no less than every foot on average, and the TCE plot versus depth shows that you get these zones that are actively transporting contaminants and that have contaminants in the matrix as well, separated by clean zones and very large concentration changes over relatively short distances as well. Slide 34 shows the core sampling process. So we use a HQ coring tool typically. We pull the core out, log it and inspect it, but while we're doing that, we're also figuring out where we're going to take these samples, pulling the samples out of the core, bringing them in to a crushing unit where they're crushed with as little loss to volatilization as possible. They fall right out of the crusher into a vial containing methanol, and then the methanol vials are sent off to the lab. And we're going to look at this lab technique that uses microwave-assisted extraction. It was a pretty big breakthrough in terms of timing in a minute. But first, we're going to go to slide 35, excuse me, which is an example of rock core VOC concentration profiles at three sites. The one on the left is a sandstone in California. The middle one is a shale in Watervliet, New York. And on the right is a siltstone in Union, New York. These are different compounds. It's PCE and TCE in the middle, just TCE on the left, and PCE, TCE, and CIS-DCE on the right. There's a lot of data here, but you can see that the concentrations change a lot, you know, orders of magnitude over short vertical distances, and that there are clean zones between zones of active contaminant transport. Slide 36 looks at the extraction times necessary to get the mass out of these rock matrix chunks. Even after they're crushed, they're put into a shake flask and they're extracted over a period of time. And this graph shows the concentration on the vertical axis versus the time in days on the horizontal axis for a number of different samples. And you can see that in the blue triangles, the peak equilibrium concentrations were reached at about 28, 29 days. In the green line, in the middle, it was more like 35 days. And in the red line, it was 40 days. So that's a long extraction time to get all that mass out of the ground. And it doesn't lend itself to the triad approach very well at all. A chemist named Tadeusz Górecki started looking into this problem, and going to slide 37, came up with a microwave-assisted extraction technique that would expedite the whole thing, get the mass out of the rock samples much more quickly so that the data could be used while the folks were still in the field drilling. Now, MAE is a technique that's been around for a while. Tadeusz didn't invent it, but he did come up with this application to this rock problem. And it basically reduces the amount of time from 4 or 5 weeks to a couple of hours. And the actual microwaving time is only about 40 minutes. So going to slide 38, we're comparing shake flask extractions with microwave-assisted extraction. And the graph on the lower left, you can see the comparison from MAE on the vertical axis to shake flask on the horizontal axis. And there's an excellent correlation there with a high bias to the MAE, which basically means that the shake flask technique actually was losing some mass during the amount of time it was in process. So the MAE is probably better from the standpoint of conserving the mass that was originally in the sample. You can see that in both cases on the right, that you get the same basic shape of the profile in most cases, but that the MAE approach is much faster and typically gives you slightly higher concentrations. So slide 39 is the distillation or conclusions of the presentation. And essentially, the points I wanted to make are pretty simple, and that is that contaminant hydrogeology is all about spatial variability, and that it happens on a very small scale. There can be very profound changes, and you need to investigate in a high-resolution manner in order to understand the distribution of mass and the factors controlling that distribution of mass. So high-resolution site characterization is absolutely essential to groundwater contaminant investigations. And, of course, you need to apply the triad approach principles to keep everything cost-effective and efficient. And that means using real-time or near-real-time data collection tools, data management strategies. You need dynamic work strategies so that you have ways to make decisions based on the data that you're generating. And it's always good to use a toolbox approach and employ different types of data collection tools so that you can leverage the data from one type using data from another type of tool. You get a more complete and more powerful investigation that way. When I presented this at the Triad Conference last year, we hadn't yet done the core DFN bedrock investigation at a site in a Triad approach. We since have done that, and so bedrock investigations are now entering the Triad approach, I think, probably with great success. There's still going to be much slower investigations than porous media, just given the drilling times and that sort of thing, and the mobilization of the different technologies. But you can get real-time information on matrix diffusion in fractured bedrock now. So that's the conclusion of my presentation.
Okay. Thank you so much, Seth. That is fascinating, really. I think Mark's presentation is going to dovetail with that very nicely. This points out the extreme importance of a good conceptual site model. And, you know, if only we could see below the ground, which is actually what we're trying to do. And I think that these approaches that we're talking about here offer a much, much greater visual penetration, if you will, at least on a mental basis, into the underground situation, and extremely important. So I was wondering if anyone on the telephone had questions for Seth.
This is Jean. As a reminder, if you've muted your line, simply hit #6 to unmute it so you can ask your questions out loud.
Yes, Jean, I meant to do that. And if you wanted to submit a question online, you can use your little question mark icon to go ahead and submit that question. I think you've wowed them. Okay.
Maybe put them to sleep. I don't know.
No, I don't think so. If they're here looking at this, they're not sleeping at this particular moment. They're thinking about how they're going to use these tools and approaches to help understand their sites. Okay, hearing no questions, I'm going to say let us move along. And I do not see any questions submitted online. Jean, do you see any questions there? I've got my...
No, I don't. But just as a reminder for those of you who are new to the seminars, there's a series of icons along the very top of those slides. Some of them you can use to move forward through the materials as the presenter announces their slides. If you have a pop-up blocker on, you'll want to disable that, because if you click the question mark icon, that'll open up a new window where you can type up your comments or questions, which we'll read to the speakers on your behalf. You can do that at any point in time. So if you haven't had the chance to do that yet, feel free to go ahead and follow up with that. And do it now, and when we get to the next Q&A break, we'll be sure to take the questions that have been submitted online.
Yes, and Seth, you'll be staying right till the end of the presentation. So as we come towards the end of Mark's presentation, we'll be looking at, there will be an opportunity for others to ask questions about your presentation as well.
Yeah, I'll be here.
Okay, that sounds very good. Mark, are you ready to go here?
I sure am.
Okay. Let's go ahead and start with your presentation, which is going to start on, I believe, slide. Sorry, I lost my place here. Okay. I'll wait. Pardon me here. I'm going through. Here we go. All right. So we're now on... slide 40, and Mark, I just wanted to just take a moment to talk about groundswell technologies, because as one of the founders of that, or its founder rather, you guys do automated earth monitoring and sensor deployment, telemetry, real-time contouring software, and delivering next-generation solutions in the field of subsurface contamination. These are coming up. New technologies arise all the time, and I think it's a huge challenge to us to keep up with the speed that the field is moving at. And you are one of the leaders in that. So you also, groundswell does subsurface contamination investigation, sustainable water management, does some homeland security work, and you have your Web 2.0 applications, which are I think some of the state-of-the-art software out there now, to try to improve and actually does improve the accuracy, timeliness, and cost-effective of automated monitoring in these industries. I think that's where we're going in the future, and the importance of the field investigation and the use of these tools is pointed out by the presentations that we're hearing now. Dr. Mark Graham, who received his PhD from the Ronald Brink School of Environmental Science and Management at University of California, Santa Barbara, has an MS in Geology from San Diego State University and a BA in Chemistry, University of California, Santa Barbara. He's going to talk to us now about his technique. So, Mark, if you will just go ahead, I think we're ready for you now.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that introduction and the opportunity to present. I also want to acknowledge my collaborators here. We've got folks from all over the country that specialize in many different facets. Everybody here has a pretty significant role to play. I couldn't have done this without them. In particular, I'd like to also acknowledge ESTCP. I'll be discussing, at least for the majority of this presentation, some work that was sponsored by ESTCP while I used to work for the Navy, so I'd like to give a shout-out to the Navy as well. I guess what we are bringing from Seth's presentation are many, many different messages, but primarily, for many years, people really didn't give a lot of respect or acknowledgement to the role that spatial heterogeneity has, and in particular, the hydraulic applications and aspects were really not considered in a deep sense, if you will. We're all familiar with sites where they have one permeability or hydraulic conductivity value, and they use that to try to project where a plume is about to head or maybe where it came from. So along that theme, I'd like to continue what Seth started to discuss and then present perhaps a variation on that theme, but it also dovetails and overlaps very well. So I applaud the folks who decided to have me follow Seth. Although it's a tough thing to do, I think the topics definitely are amenable. So the discussion here is really going to cover some emphasis on the hydraulic aspects. I will discuss some chemical aspects, but really I'm going to describe a tool that that I developed while I was with the Navy to get some very resolved hydraulic measurements using direct push technologies. In addition, what we had to do, as Seth mentioned, is you have to manage your data appropriately to come up with the right kinds of conceptualizations. We worked very closely with Dr. Norm Jones from BYU, who is a principal author of the GMS package, the groundwater modeling software package. So we had to modify that to be able to handle these new highly resolved data sets. So with that, I'll go to slide 41. Several objectives here. Primarily, I want to describe the demonstration of what we refer to as the high-resolution piezocone, the HRP. We use this to determine the direction and the rate of groundwater flow. Highly resolved approach that I'll get into in a bit. Now, what does this mean, demonstrate? If you're familiar with the ESTC process, what we try to do is compare our methods to more conventional methods. So although there aren't really many conventional high-resolution methods yet, we tried to do our best, and you'll see what I mean in a few slides. And then we developed models utilizing various data sets. Some are conventional data sets, and then some are the more highly resolved data sets. And then we generated these simulations and predictions, and then we compared those predictions to each other. I'll focus also on the technical side, how we integrated this data set with the GMS platform to generate these 3D, not only hydraulic fields, the velocity fields, but also contaminant flux distribution. And then I'm going to introduce an innovative remediation performance monitoring concept that we're just starting to develop at this point. We've actually developed a couple key pieces, and in the coming months we're looking forward to having something that I think is going to have a profound impact on our industry. Slide 42. So what is the HRP, the high-resolution piezocone? I showed a few images on the right side there. Many people have probably used this type of probe. It's advanced with a conventional cone penetrometer system, and it could be advanced also with a geoprobe type of system or an AMS power probe. Essentially, we modified the transducer We upgraded the software and the data processing capabilities significantly. And what I've shown there in the lower right is where I unscrewed the tip so that you can actually see this transducer. Essentially, in the white ring is a porous ring, and we fill it with a non-compressible oil. So typically we'll use glycerin, or some people like to use a silicon oil. And as you advance this into the subsurface, you're generating pressures that are not natural. These pressures and the measurements are essentially the pressures are transferring that to the transducer through that porous element that's filled with the non-compressible fluid. So the pressure on the probe is being recorded at that transducer. Now, since we're increasing the pressure, we want to watch, we can stop that at a particular depth, and we can watch that pressure dissipate. The rate of dissipation is related to the permeability or the hydraulic conductivity. It's like a mini slug test, if you will. Then the final pressure is related to the head, much like what Seth showed in his head logs there. So I'll get more into this, but the bottom line is that the modification allows us to get resolutions down to about 1 inch of head. This opens the door significantly. What it means is that for a small site like a gas station or perhaps a dry cleaner facility and release or a small underground storage tank of an acre or smaller, you can actually be able to determine the direction of flow or the head distribution. Not only that, but because of that resolution, you can get the three dimensions resolved from that data set when you model this correctly. You can see the vertical gradient, if you will. Now, while we're collecting this head information, we're collecting soil type information as well, conventional soil type information. We do some pretty interesting things with that information. We could get a hydraulic conductivity correlation. We could even get a correlation with effective porosity. So we're getting an incredible amount of data from each push, and then we basically sort out what we need from that information to generate not only conceptual models, but transport models as well. So we get hydraulic conductivity from that pressure dissipation test I discussed, and then also we have a soil lookup chart that gives you basically order of magnitude types of resolution. So I'll give you examples of what that data looks like. As with most direct push technologies, there's very minimal worker exposure to contaminants. Hello?
This is just a reminder to please keep your phone lines on mute so we can hear a conversation in the side. Again, hit *6 to mute your phone lines now. Thank you.
Thank you, Jean. The system has been installed on the Navy San Diego Site Characterization Analysis Penetrometer System for a few years, and recently it's been licensed to AMS, so commercialization is in progress. Slide 43. Now, it looks like there was a little bit of a spacing issue here, but I'll get to that in a second. I'm using seepage velocity to essentially create our velocity fields that we'll use in our flux. So you have that seepage velocity here as we're depicting in its most simplified form as the hydraulic conductivity, which we get from the piezocomb, times that hydraulic gradient, which we also get from the piezocomb, divided by the effective porosity. There are a couple different ways that you can get that. We're just using a lookup estimate based on soil type. To get contaminant flux, we multiply that velocity times the concentration that's co-located for that value. Okay, so, and then we generate a field of this flux. Now, I want to introduce a caveat here. Most practitioners are currently using Darcy's velocity, so they're not considering effective porosity in their flux evaluation. When you're trying to do fate and transport modeling, I highly recommend seepage velocity. When you're trying to do flux distribution, currently our model allows us to use the seepage velocity version of flux, but pretty soon we're going to enable users to select either the Darcy or the seepage velocity option. Slide 44, please. This picture here, this cartoon, was put together by Carl Enfield several years ago at the EPA, and it immediately struck a chord with me. What he's depicting is the, in the color code, relates to the contaminant concentration. The red being the most contaminated, and the blue being the least contaminated. The vectors that are going through the source control plane that are in the direction of the contaminant and groundwater flow, the length of the vector is proportional to the flux. Some people depict that as a J, some as an F, but essentially that flux is, again, proportional to the seepage velocity or the Darcy velocity as well as the concentration. Now, most regulatory standards and engineering design for remediation are based on concentration. While that's helpful, I don't believe it tells the whole story, and this is why I like this this depiction so much. If you look at the source control plane, in particular under the A, you see that there's a red zone with a large vector, and that is sort of what you might imagine would be a high-risk zone. That's what you think of when you see high concentrations distributed throughout the subsurface. However, if you look under the A prime, you get a high concentration, but you have a small vector. That is telling us that it's in a low flow area. So maybe you're in a silty environment, or maybe even a clay. Now, this has a profound impact on how you might prioritize your remediation strategies, as well as how you might go about monitoring this. And I believe it has a profound implication on how we might interpret the associated risks. So if we go to slide 45, since we don't have animations here, I have a slight modification here, but I just wanted to point out that high concentration does not always imply high risk, or it doesn't always mean high risk. It seems to imply it at least conventional terms, but I don't believe that it really is always a high risk, and we've all seen this before. That hydraulic component that is essential for deriving the flux can come from something like PisaCone or other high-resolution tools. Slide 46. In order to be able to handle this data, we work very closely, as I mentioned, with the folks from BYU, Norm Jones in particular, to modify some of the interpolative capabilities of the GMS package to run some multivariate analyses to resolve both seepage velocity as well as the flux distribution. So one of the challenges was, if you measure head, that pressure, the hydraulic pressure, if you remember in the seepage velocity equation and in the Darcy velocity equation, you're talking about gradient. Well, we have to convert this scalar head value to a gradient. So the way that we do this, if you go to slide 47, is we essentially we create a grid, and then at every node, at every corner of each cell that we've discretized, within this 3D domain, if you will, we perform a finite difference analysis in three dimensions. So we essentially convert the scalar head value to a three-dimensional vector value of gradient. Okay? Slide 48. Once we've done this, we've essentially started by interpolating all the head values, then assigning to the grid these values, running these finite difference analyses, then we merge that with the interpolated values for hydraulic conductivity and effective porosity and concentration. So we then solve for velocity at each node, and then we solve 4 contaminant flux to each node. To get the concentration, we're not using the high-resolution PISACOTE. We would refer to some of the technologies that Seth described before, maybe the membrane interface probe with some confirmation samples, a Waterloo APS, etc. So that gives us the information we need to generate this three-dimensional domain. Slide 49. Our approach for the comparison was as follows. We first needed to design a test cell that would be comprised of conventional monitoring tools like short screen wells. Now, our short screens that we're using essentially rendered this non-conventional if you really wanted to get technical. But we wanted to try to simulate using conventional approaches an environment that would be amenable to comparison. So we first pushed the PISACOTE to get soil type profiles, and then we utilized that to design wells. And then we installed these wells, and then we measured head, and we measured other types of parameters like hydraulic conductivity. And then we would generate a K-field. Then we would push the high-resolution PISACOTE adjacent to each of these locations and measure hydraulic conductivity, head, effective porosity, etc. And then we would interpolate the information as separate data sets within GMS. And then we would generate the models, and we ran our comparisons. So slide 50. I want to maybe take a tangential segue just for a second here. Jeff Farr from the Bureau of Rec and myself, we recognized early on with Dave Nielsen and several others that most people in the industry are not really designing monitoring wells the way we were taught in graduate school. Obviously, ASTM recommends that you collect a sample, soil sample, and you run a sieve analysis, and then you try to fit a curve based on that analysis to determine what types of sand pack and slot size you would then use. But as we know, there are some prohibitive reasons why most people don't do that. And most of those are related to cost and time. So as a result, a lot of folks are in the industry installing wells that are essentially one-size-fits-all types of design. We can go into the reasons why that is not desirable, but I wanted to point out that what Jeff and I did to try to address this is, since we're collecting soil type data, we studied several thousand examples that he has in the Bureau of Reclamation's data repository, where they had co-penetrometer soil type information along with sieve analyses. And then based on this correlation, we created a lookup chart and embedded that into our processing software. So now we could take soil type information and then design wells based on that. So at the site, as you can see, from about 10 to 13 feet or so was our target zone. We ended up, it was very easy for us to say, okay, there's a 20-40 sand pack recommendation for that depth, as well as an 010 slot size. So that helped us with our initial well. Note that as we proceeded with the development of this test site, my desire was to really focus on the advective zones and reduce the diffusivity or the diffusion impacts that we might observe. In addition, we wanted to go for these high K zones primarily because we wanted to demonstrate that with this new tool and the software and the rapid processing capabilities that we've introduced, we could actually measure hydraulic conductivities on the order of 10 to the minus 2 centimeters per second. I'll go back into slide 51. So here's our actual demonstration site in map view. What we're showing is W1, W2, and W3 were our initial wells. There were 3-foot screens based on our initial observations with our cone penetrometer pushes. The 13 clusters that exist were essentially placed in the cell, if you will, in a manner as follows. Each cluster has three short screen piezometers, 6-inch screens, okay, 8 to 8.5 feet, 10.5 to 11 feet, and 13.5 to 14 feet below grade. Originally we were actually planning on releasing a tracer, actually creating models with both conventional data and then the high resolution PISACOM based data, then releasing a tracer and evaluating how well the predictions matched the observations. When we did finally release the tracer, we were having some problems picking it up. The detector that we were using, we had some problems, but that's another story. So when we ended up opting to export the velocity fields that we observed and then making predictions with the model, and then comparing those predictions. And I'll get into more detail about that in a bit. So slide 52. These are just some shots from the field efforts. You see on the upper left where we had the SCAP system, the Navy SCAP system. It's lifted on its hydraulics there. We're actually in the middle of a push. We're collecting our initial data. In the middle, I'm holding a pre-packed 3-foot screen, that we layer and placed into the subsurface. We used a tracer test, to try to evaluate the direction of the groundwater flow. At a site that's this small, we observed just by looking at water levels that the direction of flow is extremely difficult to resolve using even a 3-foot screen. And that's primarily because, we had a very small gradient. And so very subtle changes in water level would make you point in a different direction. So we therefore decided to release a tracer, a calcium chloride rock salt tracer, and track that using time-lapse resistivity, 4 dimensions. So that's what helped us design the orientation. Once this was designed, then we installed the 3/4-inch wells. You see that there's a geoprobe there in the field. And in each well box, we've got 3 wells for the shallow, mid, and deep levels. And then we follow that up with the hydraulic test and well development, obviously, before that. Slide 53.
Mark, just a reminder to everybody on the line, please use *6 to mute and #6 to unmute your line. We are picking up a little bit of, occasionally picking up a little bit of side conversation. Sorry to interrupt. Thank you.
Thank you. This is on the upper left on slide 53, we're showing the system about to be deployed into the subsurface. You can see that I have a very high-tech way to zero our probe depth with my duct tape. It's the surfer panacea, if you will. Then we performed several demonstrations. We had folks from DOE, DOD, private industry. Many regulators came out. What I'm showing down below, it looks like the arrows were replaced, I guess, or they moved during the transfer here of the file. But this is a newer system that is actually it's a wireless system. There's no cable that goes through there, so it opens up the door for many new advantages. It's a system that AMS has just put together. It's been in the field now. The flange system is essentially the receiver, and there's a transmitter that sends data to the surface that's in the probe itself. Slide 54. Here's what our data looks like, or one way to present our information. And much like the logs that Seth has presented, I'll go through a couple of these, but it's oriented very similarly to many of the logs that he showed where depth is on the vertical axis. So the log on the left is the soil type based on conventional load cells in the penetrometer system. The next log over is called K Robertson. It's based on a Robertson Campanella lookup table. So we have essentially a neural net that's built in. And then it converts the soil type to the a hydraulic conductivity estimate, order of magnitude here, for every centimeter that we get a data point for soil type. The next column is called K, Perez, and Furiel, and there's an algorithm that we apply to the dissipation test. So we actually stop the pushes at particular selected depths, and then we've got the readings that I'll discuss in a second. And these are the results of those readings in terms of hydraulic conductivity for those specific depths. Then we have the porosity reading. It's an effective porosity estimate where we convert soil type to that effective porosity. So let's focus on the graph on the lower right. These are the actual dissipation tests for the separate depths that we conducted these. So this is all for a single push. So, for instance, we went down to 7.8 feet, I believe that is, and ran a dissipation test. So the data, again, the time that it takes to dissipate is going to dictate what the hydraulic conductivity reading is. And then the final pressure is related to the hydraulic profile, if you will. It's that head. If you had a very short screen well at that depth, that would be the pressure that you would read. And if you look above on the upper right, we do plot the hydraulic pressure profile. So these are the final pressures and that came out of these dissipation test depth readings. And one thing that's really beautiful about this is in a single push, let's say that you had a clay and you wanted to evaluate whether or not that was confining. Well, most people will associate a clay with a confining unit. But that's a textual observation, and they're associating some kind of hydraulic interpretation to it. Here, you can actually measure the hydraulics. So, for instance, you could just plot the bottom two. If there was a clay between, say, 11 and 12 feet, you could graph the bottom two points at about 14 and 15 feet and get a final pressure, a water table elevation, if you will, as that curve is extrapolated back to the surface. And then simultaneously you can have a separate curve that shows the three dissipation test results from 11 feet down to about 8 feet, or 7.5 feet or so, 7.8. And if those fall on a different line, then you can say that there is hydraulic isolation, or you could even determine whether or not there's a vertical component of flow, much like what Seth showed with his graphic. So there are many ways you can slice and dice this data and get incredibly rich information that then gets exported into models for extremely, detailed interpretations, conceptualizations, as well as analytical modeling. So slide 55. We're just plotting the head values that we got at the end of one of the days here, and I'm rotating this so that you can see just the head distributions. You can get such rich, detailed information here. You can see where there's a gap in that one zone in the lower left. That usually implies that the gradient's extremely shallow there. There's not that much change over that distance there that we're looking through the gap. This is very encouraging. If you can see this type of detail with these types of tools, and these, remember, are only offset by 5 feet apiece each push. Imagine how this would work when you're offset by 50 feet or so. So we're extremely pleased with this. Slide 56. This is a little bit more detailed, where we took the pedicone head data and we peeled off that surface of the 3D domain, if you will, and we compared it to the head values that we measured in the well. Now, they're not exact, but what we see is that the total range is very close. It's less than an inch over this entire domain of about 30 feet across by 10 feet wide. We also see that, there are some subtle nuances in terms of the direction of the flow based on that gradient, but that it's not tremendous. So we were very pleased to see this as some of our early data sets. Slide 57. When we look at the hydraulic conductivity comparison, note that we are using what we call K-well as the control. That's what we measured in the well, okay? And the chart on, or the graphic on the left is, the pure data, and then we log transform that information for the graphic on the right. Essentially, there are five different hydraulic conductivity values that we can obtain using the high-resolution PISA cone. We get a minimum, a maximum, and a mean based on a neural network that we've embedded. And I can go into detail on that if somebody has questions about it or if they want to contact me later and see how we calculate that. We get a K-form, which is what we were plotting on that chart, the Perez and Farrell. And then we have KLC, which is the lookup chart, which is just based on the soil type. Now, what's nice about this is since you get a range, you can model the minimum and the maximum K values and then make predictions about when you think a plume will reach a particular location or how long it will take to clean up and really bracket your estimate in terms of time and space. Now, what we observed is that the K-mean, which most people will use, and the KLC, which most people will use, fall within a factor of about 2 of our control. That's very good. That's exceptional. The min, max, and form formula values are within about a half of order of magnitude of the K-well value, so that also was very encouraging. Now, the values that we derived from the PISA cone pushes range much more widely than those that we derived from the slug test that we conducted in those six-inch screen wells. Now, that's not surprising because those measurements at the PISA cone, with the PISA cone are really point measurements. And we get an averaging, even though it's only over 6 inches. Remember what Seth was talking about, when he talked about the spatial variability. There's an averaging that goes on there. So as a result, we don't see as much range in that data from the control data from the well. So we found that to be very fascinating as well. Slide 58. Here's where we're going to start looking at the information that gets processed through GMS. What we're looking at here are the mid-zone, which is 10 to 10 and a half feet, interpolations of the hydraulic conductivity. On the control is the well K up in the upper left. The mean is in the middle on the lower column there. And, you know, we can say that, okay, in terms of range and spatial distribution, there's, you know, at least range, we see some similarity. Again, I'm not making an analytical judgment here. I'm making more of an observation here. So we were, you know, we're saying, well, what can we do with this? Well, slide 59. This is where we really got in a lot more detail in terms of our analysis of how well the data compares. We've got the well information on the left and the PISA cone information on the right, and what we're doing is we're essentially processing the data and calculating the distribution of seepage velocity. Okay? So if you look again at that mid-zone, which is the top images, yeah, you can sort of see that there are some similarities, but nothing really jumps out at you. The first row is the first row of wells if you went in the downgrading direction, which is about in the from right to left in a diagonal manner there. You know, the first row, you don't really see that much in terms of similarity, at least from an observational standpoint. I mean, the range of values are acceptable. But then look at the center line, which would go right through that plume, if you will, right through that test cell. We start to see some fabric there that looks very similar in terms of shape there. So that we were encouraged by that. Slide 60. Now we're looking at flux determinations. And notice it's day 49 projection. So what did we do here? We took the velocity fields from each of our models, and then we exported those into the fate and transport model that's also under GMS. Then we simulated the release of a solute, and then watched what happened over time. Then we extracted that solute distribution for key times, and then we merged that with the velocity field to get the flux distribution. Okay? Hopefully that makes sense. And then what you get are beautiful three-dimensional images of the projection after 49 days, based on the well information as well as the pisacone mean K data. So in that top image in Matthew, you're still looking at the mid-zone, 10 to 10.5 feet below grade. You see that, you know, there are some directional nuances and some differences there. Not a tremendous amount, but you do see a little bit of a difference there. In that first row, you see that the well information predicts that you get breakthrough through that first row to a little bit more significant extent than what the pisacone data showed, at least for that mean data set. And then you look at the center line, and you're getting a very similar picture for the distribution of that flux. Now, if we were to use flux as a remediation guide, and I was a remediation engineer at the site, and I got this data at the end of the workday, I would pretty much come up with the same conclusion about how to approach the remediation of that site. So that, to us, is extremely encouraging. Slide 61, please. Now, we looked at many different types of iterations. This is a subset of the primary types of data sets that we looked at. I'm not going to go into all of these, but we want to look at concentration versus flux distribution for a couple selected iterations here. So if you look at slide 62, what we're showing are the predictions based on these measurements and the comparisons between the well information, again, which is our control, the K-mean information, the K-lookup chart information, and then the average K. Let's just focus on the well information and the K-mean. On the left, we're looking at the concentration distribution, okay, in 2D, for day 14, 49, and 84, okay? If you compare the K-mean to K-well, again, as we saw in that last picture, you see that there's the K-well would predict a little bit faster flow and a little bit different direction, okay, than the K-mean. If you look at the flux distribution, again, you see some of these nuances come out. But again, the conclusion would be very similar about how you might go about remediating the site. Again, keep in mind that these little dots here are 5 foot apart from each other. So spatially and temporally, we think that this is very consistent. Slide 63. If we look at the objectives of the ESTCP project, we met the criteria in every category. We're very pleased about that. In terms of the accuracy for head values, the hydraulic conductivity, the transport model, we use something that evaluates the model efficiency, and then we also are looking at the time required to generate a 3D conceptual and transport model. And as we all know, the triad-based approaches are much more not only time efficient, but also cost-effective. And I'll get into some more detail on that in a second. So slide 64. We were asked to look at cost comparisons for generating a three-dimensional flux field using quote-unquote conventional approaches versus the high-resolution triad-based approaches. And what I'm trying to do here, if you've followed any of my older reports on Dean Apple characterization approaches, I am a stickler for trying to compare apples to apples where possible. So in this case, what I did was, one, I assumed that the high-resolution pisacone case would also include something like the membrane interface probe as well as a confirmation sampling to generate the flux field, okay? So that's one case, that's the HRP case. The other cases, the conventional cases, would include installation of wells, performance of aquifer tests, collecting samples, and then the assumption was that we would look at 10 locations and 3 depths. So the conventional approach would be to install short screen wells in 30 locations. So 3 different depths, 10 map locations. And then I derived some cost comparisons here, and I got pretty detailed And I've got spreadsheets if people are interested in seeing this. But essentially what I look at is the 3/4 inch direct push approach, which is obviously going to be more cost effective than drilled well. I looked at the 2-inch direct push case. Then I looked at the drilled wells, obviously, and then the HRP approach. Again, with the chemical analyses being covered by the MIP with confirmation sample. So, what do we see? Well, I separated this into 3 depth categories, meaning the total depth would be 20 feet, 50 feet, and 75 feet for these 10 locations that we're going to investigate. If you look at the HRP for 20 feet, we're looking at about $40,000 or so, $40,000 versus $100,000 to $150,000 for that same, to get that same flux picture. Okay? So the cost benefits here are considerable. As you go deeper, provided that you could advance the direct push probes to those depths, you see that the margin increases significantly. So, for instance, at 75 feet, you're looking at potentially saving hundreds of thousands of dollars for your investigation. Slide 65. We were asked to try to evaluate what kinds of savings we might be able to derive within a year or so. So once this is commercialized, which is going to be very shortly, if we have a couple of these GeoProbe and AMS types of versions running around the country, say that we could run this at 20 sites within a year, which I don't think is inconceivable, we're looking at saving a tremendous amount of money, $1.5 to $5 million just in a year. Time. Slide 66. Time comparisons. We weren't asked to provide this, but I wanted to emphasize this particularly because we're a triad community and time is really critical. In the segmented world of, you know, preliminary assessment, site investigation, RIFS, etc., timing is critical. We've been dealing with some of these sites for decades. If you go after generation of a flux model using the HRP MIP combination with a target depth of 20 feet in these 10 locations, you know, I can get you a picture probably within 3 days and a draft report, a final report to you on your desk or electronically or shared through a web interface within 2 weeks. No problem. Try doing that with the direct push well type of scenario that I described. You have to wait for laboratory results. You have to wait for all kinds of other factors to take place. Then you have to generate your models and your reports, etc. You're looking at, you know, 3 to 4 months before you've got that kind of resolution in that kind of report. So as you can see, the time benefits are very significant. 67. So what are the future plans? In terms of technology transfer, as I mentioned, the technology has been licensed to AMS and ENVI, and they've been in the field this week with the first commercial system, so we're anticipating that people could actually start seeing these at their site, you know, within the next few months. IPRC guidance is underway. For flux methodology, the first draft should be out within the next few weeks. We had a conference call yesterday, and this technology is being covered under one of the TransSect applications. ASTM D6067 has recently been upgraded. We're waiting on the final approval of that standard, so you could go to your regulator and demonstrate that the regulators have been endorsing this technology. 2 final reports were recently released. One you can find on the Clue-In site, and in the cost of performance you can find at the ESTCP site, and I've provided the links below. Now, as was described earlier, I'm going to take this to the next level now. We're in the process of doing so, and I'm extremely excited about this. There were a couple of niches that we needed to fill to allow us to do what I'm about to describe. One niche was to allow us to get rapid hydraulic information and then assimilate that. And another was to be able to design wells and then install those while you're still in the field. So I coined the phrase single mobilization solution, whereby we would use some of the tools that that Seth described for expedited chemical characterization, and then we would use this type of tool or many others that might be available for the hydraulic characterization, generate the models. You would deploy a long-term monitoring network. You would design and deploy it while you're still in the field. And then I'm advocating that we could place sensors in those, and then we can take that initial model and use that to not only guide remediation, but to also evaluate either the potential for natural attenuation, or regardless of what remediation option you select, we can use that same long-term monitoring network to evaluate how effective the remediation effort is. So I think the potential here is tremendous, and I'll describe that in a little bit more detail. My goal is to automate that so that you can sit at your desktop and just see how effective your remediation efforts are proceeding. So slide 68. Now we've talked a lot about using Flux for remediation design. Remediation effectiveness, as I mentioned, I think if you look at Flux over time, it tells you a lot about how effective your remediation efforts are. So again, as I mentioned, you can generate the initial model, seepage velocity, concentration. You can use various approaches, even conventional approaches. You can install your well network. Now you can monitor the water levels or the head values and concentrations, because if you think about the relationships for Flux, the algorithms that we discussed earlier, the only dynamic constituents, really, are the gradient, which is calculated by the head values, and the concentration. So the hydraulic conductivity distribution, we can assume, is relatively constant. You're probably going to have some exceptions to that, say that an earthquake hits or a tsunami or some other type of natural disaster. But in most instances, we could assume that that K distribution is probably going to be relatively constant. So if we know that, and then we just feed new iterations of head and concentration into that model, then we can actually track the flux distribution, use that to evaluate the plume status, and I think that it's obviously useful for a remediation metric, but there's a new report that's about to come out that was sponsored by CERTA, and Lynn Wood and others did a tremendous job that I think with the input that they're going to present to the field, pretty soon it could potentially become a regulatory metric whereby you could define the flux through a source plane as effectively evaluating whether or not the site is going to naturally attenuate. Slide 69. Again, the single mobilization solution, I've discussed this already, I'll go rather quickly. Delineate the plume, evaluate the hydrologic properties, set up your network, do your surveys. You can generate an initial model with GMS interpolations for both conceptual and analytical models, and then you would update that with head and concentration. Again, you can use conventional data, or you can automate this with sensors. So slide 70. Here's a depiction of how this might look. What I'm showing are familiar images where you've got, I'm saying it's TCE concentration, or excuse me, TCE flux distribution here, in 3D along the center line and through that first row. Now, if you look on the bottom row, the histograms are essentially tracking for each particular time step the cumulative flux, either through a volume or through those surfaces. So if we go to slide 71, notice that we see that the plume has started to migrate through, and then we see that there's been a change in the cumulative mass flux. If we go to 72, again, not only do we see a change in the cumulative mass flux as that plume migrates through that domain, but we can see that there's a decrease in the cumulative mass flux. That's what I feel could become not only the remediation performance metric or the remediation metric so that you can try to quantify now how much mass you've removed, but I believe that at some point you may be able to get to where regulators would be willing to accept this kind of information as a target remediation goal. For instance, if you can prove that once flux gets below a certain point, then and the receptor is X distance away, down gradient, that once the flux gets below that threshold, the concentration at that receptor will be below the action level, then I think you'll have something to hang your hat on. We're a little ways from that right now, but it's getting closer and more realistic. Slide 73 just shows that final iteration. Slide 74. We can draw several conclusions from this effort and some of the other items that I presented here. Primarily, we're very excited because the high-resolution PISA cone results demonstrate very good agreement with short-screen well data. Although we're calling it conventional information, the way we design this, our quote-unquote conventional data or configuration, I think, is even more like a triad approach and more high-res than what most traditional conventional applications might look like. We can get highly resolved two-dimensional and three-dimensional distributions of the hydraulic properties, and when concentration distributions are understood, we can get three-dimensional distributions of the flux, now using direct push and GMS. The single mobilization solutions are now possible, so instead of having this segmented process of PASI, RIFS, and where one contractor might not trust the results of another contractor when a decision's finally made to proceed with a different group, you know, we can basically compress that into a short duration, those field efforts. I'm talking about a matter of days as opposed to years. We get exceptional capabilities for understanding the plume architecture that would help with our remediation decision, and then for monitoring the network for long-term evaluation of the site, significant time and cost-saving potential, and as I discussed, the new paradigm would be to perform long-term monitoring and remediation performance using sensors and automated model updates. 75. Looks like we're having a spacing problem here, but many, many people to thank. This is just a partial list. Folks from the Navy that I used to work with, CERTIP, ESTCP, many folks from University of Connecticut and consultants and just a lot of really talented folks here had a significant role to play. Slide 76. And that's basically it. I welcome questions. Kirby, are you
okay. Here? Hey. Yeah, here I am, sorry. I had mine on mute. yeah, okay, fantastic. Boy, that is, there's a lot of information there, Mark. That's, as you said, exceptional. That's very, very interesting. I just wanted to make a remark that managing data, I think, is something that we here at EPA have been extremely attuned to now, especially with the amount of data that is actually exists on many sites, and the ability to get that into some sort of an automated system so that you can use the kind of models that you're talking about on it. And then the importance, of course, is minimal invasiveness of these new field technologies, I think, is reminds me of the medical field, that when you do exploratory operations for cancer, well, you don't do those really anymore. So, and I think that that is one of the things that does contribute to the dollar saved, the time saved, and I thought, well, 2 weeks to a final report from in the field is a pretty pretty desirable thing. In fact, it reminds me very much of what I was hearing Matty Stanislaus, our new assistant administrator, that's spelled M-A-T-H-Y, but it's pronounced Matty, so everybody can get that. He's now talking about, like, what can we do to save time, increase the speed of the investigations, and the accuracy of those things, and how do we determine cost and time saved? And I think he's vitally interested in those things too. So, let me just open this up for any questions that might be here for either Mark or for Seth. And let me just wait for a second and see if I have anybody asking a question. Hearing none, if you go to that last, the thank you page, see Mark there on the wave, surfing. And the very last page here is our links page. I just wanted to remark that there are links to additional resources here. There's also a feedback form, which I would really encourage you to fill out. We want the feedback. We use that to improve as all of us do, and it's important to hear your observations, your ideas, your thoughts. Also, in the additional resources, there will be a link to these presentations, and also having a voice track along with it, so you can hear everything that people have said. So let me open one more time to questions before I thank our guests. Hearing none, I'm going to say hello. I thought I heard one, but I didn't. So, okay, well, Seth and Mark, we really, really appreciate you coming and giving us these highly instructional lessons. I think that the two presentations really dovetailed well together. I was really very interested in the microwave technique. I think that's another speed operation that looks like that can be extremely successful. And of course, Mark, your models are pretty fantastic too. So, let me say thank you to you, and we'll be closing out just a few minutes early. I'm sure that no one will mind that. And, hopefully we will, see you guys again in, the near future for more presentations of such an interesting and useful nature. So thank you both, and I will say goodbye.